of introducing this amazing team for Socialism Fundraising event. So we are here to fundraise for Socialism 2012. It's an annual conference that happens in Chicago with a group of radical activists who talk about politics, art, culture, all those things. So that is the occasion to bring you all together today. If you're interested in finding out more about socialism, you can at the conference, you can do it from the front desk. They have information there. You can also register for the conference if you're interested. And basically, we're putting together a scholarship fund to help people get out there. So it's my pleasure this evening to introduce Davey D, who's a nationally recognized journalist and co-founder of Hard Knock Radio, and Boots Riley, who is a musician, artist, and activist, frontman for The Crew and the Street Sweepers Social Club. And his book, Lyrics in Context, will be available this coming August from Haymarket Books. It is in our little Haymarket Books pamphlet if you want to pick one up from the front later. And his new album, Sorry to Bother You, is the soundtrack to a film that he wrote, and that will be out in October. So we're going to have a discussion about the relationship between art, culture, and resistance to capitalism. We'll have a discussion from the front, and then we'll have a chance later to open it up to take questions from the audience. So enjoy the discussion.
Okay, well, first of all, thanks for having us here. And it's going to be a little tricky to have this conversation with Boots because I've known Boots over 20 years. And not only have we had these conversations on the radio about 15 million times, just when we run into each other and just, you know, on a friendship tip, we battle back and forth. Our politics are slightly different. I think we want the same thing. But we all, you know, I definitely always challenging him, and he's challenged me. And so hopefully some of the best of those type of dialogues are able to come out. Boots asked me, you know, what's going to be the first question? And I never know what the first question is going to be until I get in the room and you kind of get a feel of it. You know, so really my first question is going to be like, how can we use art to get Barack Obama elected? Now that's just a joke. this ain't the crowd, I get it. But on a serious tip, I just came back from a gathering where people are having that conversation. And it's not a new one. They had the conversation on many different communities all around the country. How can we use art, you know, to get this man into the White House? And it was held in probably every city I went to in 2008. And many people will argue, there being books written about it and documentaries to say that various forms of art help elevate this man into the White House. But that conversation didn't start with Barack Obama's election. We've had it when John Kerry was running, and we've had it when Al Gore was running, and we definitely had it with Bill Clinton, and some people said him playing saxophone on the on MTV or Arsenio Hall show was like an indication that he's cool, he's hip, he's connected to art, let's cast a vote for him. We've seen people vote for Arnold Schwarzenegger based upon his association with art. And so we keep having this conversation. And so with that being said, the first question that I would ask to Boots is, why are we continuing to have this conversation? And the add-on to that question is that I'm very deliberately I didn't define art, culture, and resistance in asking that question. So, and there was a reason for it. So I want to see how you see that. Why are we still having this discussion from 20 years to now?
Well, I think 20 years ago was a very different time politically as far as the movement was concerned. 20 years ago, I may be exaggerating, but I feel like demonstrations were about 5 people big on average. And people have been, before then and since then, looking for creative ways to build a movement. I think that search leads us to look to artists. Unfortunately, although everybody is an artist and should be and should have the time to develop that, a few people are identified as artists because they've had either the luxury or the happenstance to be told that they should develop that or, you know. And so that's why that question comes up. People are tired of the same old chants, you know. They're tired of the same having the same ways to skin a cat. So it's an important question, and that's the reason why I got involved in doing art in the first place. I was an organizer, and I felt like nobody knew about what the ideas that we were talking about. And I wanted to get things out on a bigger level. And I was involved in a group that was their ideas about art and revolution were, I don't know, I don't think they were very progressive and thought out. And so I wasn't encouraged from those folks to do that. But what did encourage me was, and I've told this story before, is that we were doing work in the Double Rock projects here in San Francisco. And we'd go there every week organizing around something really vague like fight racism or some shit like that. But one week we went there and something had happened the day before. And what had happened was this woman, Rossi Hawkins, who I also wrote about on my first album, she got, her and her two sons were beat down by the police in Double Rock Projects, her 2 8-year-old sons. They were twins. And they were beat down by the police, and the folks in the project saw this happening and came out, and, you know, within a few minutes there was, you know, a gathering of hundreds of people around the cops. And the point was that a week before, or 2 weeks before, a guy had been beaten by the police and had been denied treatment in a hospital. The police just drove him around in the back of their police car until he died. And so the folks tried to keep the police from taking Rossi Hawkins. During that melee, one of the cops shot up in the air. And if you've ever been around a gun going off, you know, whatever you were thinking about before is not what you're thinking about at that second. You're just thinking about running away. And everybody ran. At some point, though, everybody ran back. And by the end of the night, Rossi Hawkins had been and her kids had been taken to a hospital. And the police ran out of there without their police car. The story was told to us in a lot of different ways, but the part that I told you is what stuck true from what most people told us. And the other part that everyone said was the defining moment was when everyone ran away from the cops. This was the summer of 1989, and the biggest song on the radio at the time was Public Enemy, Fight the Power. And somebody started chanting, fight the power, fight the power. And from what everyone said, it let them know that they had a unity of thought around at least that basic idea that the right thing to do right then was to turn around and go help her. And so when that story got told to me, I realized the power that music could have, and that to get these ideas out there and to try to build some consensus around the idea that we need to change the system. So I think everyone's looking for a way to get that idea out there in a broader way.
You know, here in the U.S., or in many parts, I shouldn't just say here, art, or which I define as expressions, are often commodified, and they become things that we sell. And we might sell toilet paper, might sell you some mouthwash, or we might sell you a political ideology. And I frame that this way to ask this next question. Even people in this room or other movements that feel that they're progressive and want to fight the power in a very different way, have they divorced themselves completely from that mentality of wanting to commodify art you know, either your work or somebody's painting, in the sense of wanting to sell versus really allowing you, the artist, to express yourself in a way that may be meaningful, one, or may actually accentuate your own politic. And does our audience that we wish to present art to, can they actually digest art when it's not commodified?
I mean, as far as non-commodified art, you see that all around. You see murals, you know, graffiti style and otherwise, all around all the time. Most of the people that are making hip-hop music aren't making any money off of it and couldn't sell it if they wanted to, and they do want to. But it gets out there, and, you know, so the idea that obviously people are all for ingesting art that is not commodified.
But is it making a difference, then, if it's just out there? When we walk by these murals, is the average person that we feel needs to be reached, or even people in this room, are they looking at it, feeling something, and does it inform their politic, or is it just, you know, a nice thing that might beautify the neighborhood? If they hear a song, is it something that they really take to heart, or are we automatically thinking, like, if I could just put this song to a louder audience, maybe my ideology could be sold, or whatever it is that I find attractive about it?
Well, I think that it's important to make clear here that I don't think that art in and of itself, just like I don't think talking in and of itself changes someone's worldview. I think that it opens them up to a worldview. But you have to have a movement going in one direction or the other for people to attach to. You have to have something that they can connect to and that can change their world in a real way. So if there's a mural that tells folks about, you know, that talks about a strike that they can get involved in, and then they get involved in, then yes, that mural played a part in making that happen. If there's a song that does that, then that is the same. You know, I'm not too worried about the commodification of art because, you know, that's the society that we live in. I'm not trying to create some non-capitalist world inside of capitalism. I know that I can't do that. I know that in order to change that situation, it takes getting to the working class, getting, you know, so I'm not, you know, when we signed our first contract, we basically were buying into that idea that of getting to folks on there. We've a couple times had songs on the radio, and right after it was a Coke commercial, right? So it's not about trying to create some alternative society inside there. I don't think that that can happen. I think that what needs to happen is that, you know, is the working class organizing itself and changing the system from there.
Well, you said something interesting about there needs to be a movement attached. And over the years and even now, we see that the government uses art, at the very least, in propaganda. Right now, there's a whole thing of using hip-hop to, you know, kind of smooth things out. In Middle East conflicts, if we can get a certain type of rapper with a certain type of tone and popularize that, maybe that will start to move people in a particular direction. We have artists that work for the State Department, and so again, you know, that's used. I've been around the world and been at conferences where folks are like, I've been in jail for 5, 10 years. Why you been in jail? Because I did songs about, you know, the leader of our country. You know, so we obviously see that people in power fear the potential of art. With that being said, it seems like the government has an understanding of how to use that. What should be the ideal steps that people in this room do in terms of attaching itself to art, being a part of a movement so that they can either counter or create some other type of dynamic that's to our advantage?
Well, I think that right now we're in a unique time compared to other times in my lifetime, and where we see in the United States and around the world, of course, but particularly in the United States, people coming into a whole different consciousness about, and a class consciousness about how to attack the problems of the world. And so, I mean, probably most of this room is already involved in that movement in some way, shape, or form. The whole Occupy Wall Street movement has made it clear that this is a problem of capitalism, and that there are a lot more people involved. All of a sudden, the movement is not invisible. And I have to say that that wasn't done through art. Artists were part of it, and artists a lot of times were part of it in a way that didn't have to do with their art, you know, because often artists are just folks that are looking for a way to put their feelings and ideas out there, and a movement is one way to do that. I would say that.
So what should the role be between those who are part of a movement, whether you're the artist, you know, or people who see an art? You know, if I see you and I'm a part of a movement, what should the relationship ideally be, especially if we feel that we have the same agenda?
Well, hopefully we're involved in an organization together, a committee together, or some movement with the objective of, and I feel that at this point it's the objective to make it clear that the struggle is between labor and capital, and that we need to have, you know, militant labor actions, direct actions that are able to stop profit in order to gain small changes that then help build up to a larger movement. So hopefully the relationship between someone who considers herself a revolutionary artist and the consumer of that art is one in which they're able to get them involved in something.
You know, somebody would look and say, well, Boots has a large audience, and that audience can be at the very least informed about various things. What's the definition of capitalism? And you've addressed that numerous times in songs. How do you organize? All these different types of things, because you have a bully pulpit that most people don't, just as a recording artist. So the point I'm getting at is that many people feel that artists are able to reach a larger audience. And because of that, one, do you feel as an artist that you have to constantly churn out messages to reach that audience that reflects the movement? Or should people be in concert with you so that, as you, I think you suggested before, if you put out a song that speaks to this, that they're there following up in the movement so that, you know, you planted a seed as an artist and you're not the be-all, end-all in terms of defining a movement, getting people involved, organized, et cetera, et cetera?
Well, I don't think that, you know, artists should create some art and then the movement follows behind it and makes a campaign around that art. That happens and works fine, but I don't think that that's the way to go. But
why not?
I mean, because then you have, you know, some. Why not? Because then you want the movement to be created by the folks that are involved, not just one guy making a painting and now we make a.
Okay.
You know. So, I think that what should happen is artists should be involved in a movement other than making their art. And then what they will make is naturally going to reflect their ideas that are created. When we first started, I think that the Coos stuff, you know, was just like straight off a pamphlet, you know, like it was like, and it was very much about identification. Look, I said these names, you know what I believe in. You know, and is it, I don't even know if it's something that I myself as a person I am today would like. I can't tell because I listen, I know it's me on there. But I think that as I became, you know, as I got better as an artist, I realized that, hey, I really do believe this stuff, so I don't have to try to say something in particular. If I'm really honest with myself and not blocking myself from putting all of my ideas and stuff, it's going to seep out into every single thing I do.
Right.
So if I'm involved in a movement, it's going to just naturally be part of it. I don't have to say, oh, I'm going to, this t- this time I'm going to make a police brutality song that's going to cover all of these things. No, I just make a song about what I'm feeling.
And the challenge we have is this. I mean, we're talking about resistance, and so I think a lot of people, or at least myself, feel that resistance is almost like a 24-hour, 7-day-a-week type of thing. You're always trying to resist, and you're always aware that there are outside forces pushing on you. With that being said, you know, let's just use a hypothetical. You know, here's a movement, we'll call it the Fight the Power movement, and you become the symbol of that movement, even if it's not your intention. You know, the afro, the pick, the bullhorn. Boots Riley is the leader of that movement. And even though you may not feel you're the leader, there's still a large population that looks and goes, that's that guy, he's the leader. So now when Boots moves his art in a particular direction, there's a lot more weight to it. So if you come along and do a, you know, I want to get money and, you know, 50 Cent type song, you know, get paid and, you know, we want hoes on the stripper pole, you know, that becomes the movement for a lot of people in their mind. And so, you know, this is why I'm asking.
Well, I probably wouldn't make that kind of music because
I know you won't, but.
And I'm not just talking about me in particular, because it's just because if I'm involved, people are making music that reflects what their material situation is, what they're around, what they're involved in. They make that music. It's funny because I have a friend of mine in New York was somewhere at some cafe, and my name came up, and he was like, oh, you know Boots Riley from the Coup? He's like, what are you talking? Oh, you mean, and the other guy was like, oh, you mean the dude that does those blogs? You know, so it was more, I think I've gotten in a position where I have a large bullhorn that a lot of people can hear. However, I don't think that everyone's listening to me only because they love the music. I think it's because they like the ideas and they want to find, you know, they want to find a way to connect.
Right. Well, I get that you wouldn't make that type of music because you're involved and you've been committed that way. But there are oftentimes that there have been other artists that have come to symbolize various aspects of movement for whatever reason, or they come to symbolize. A good example would be Public Enemy. You know, what Public Enemy stood for. And then when people saw Flav on, you know, all those reality shows, there was both internally and externally a lot of conversation. People were like, within the group, like, is this messing up how people perceive us? A lot of people were upset outside, like, this is not who Public Enemy should be. As artists, it's like, you know, this is what I want to do, you know? So the question becomes, I'm trying to figure out how to phrase the question.
Well, my view on a lot of the groups that came out at that time, Public Enemy, X-Clan, KRS-One, there were a lot of groups with a lot of good things to say, and they got, you know, everyone probably in this room, most of us except that dude, were there. And everyone had, you know, the African medallions, and, you know, there was new vocabulary that had to do with some sort of rebelliousness at the very least, and but there was no movement, right? So people had the African medallion and, you know, listened to the songs and went home, and the refrigerator was still empty. And then they got hyped on music that did have a movement.
Right, right.
Because the music that talks about selling dope and making $10 for selling a rock, that's real. That was connected to a real movement. And so I think that's, you know, the Public Enemy was not involved in a movement.
I would say that they were, and this is the point that I'm getting at. X-Clan, for example, was involved with Blackwatch. They were a movement before they were a group. The group came out of, you know, the movement that was led by Sonny Carson.
Well, that I joined Black Watch like everybody else in Oakland and tried to go to a meetings that never happened, I don't.
But in Brooklyn,
no,
I mean, you know, I mean, I knew them from New York, and I don't want to debate because a lot of movements aren't as powerful as they like, but they did lead, you know, 50,000 people across the bridge. They were active in their community. But over the time, you just became to associate the group and not necessarily the movement. You know, PE always had its affiliations. Most of the S1Ws and everybody's with the Nation of Islam. But we just know PE and we forget that, you know, that pretty much everybody but Chuck has been involved or is a member. So you have that type of separation. I don't know if that's a very deliberate thing. It's just the way that we proceed because we want to put things in nice little packages, or whether or not we as individuals in this room are committed to just actually join the movement. So if they say, I'm a member of this group, then do we really set up and really get behind a movement, or do we sit back and go, well, you know, the artist did this or he didn't do that, and we have these unrealistic expectations and disappointments when they move in a direction that we don't agree with. So that's the kind of challenge. I think you might have been, you and maybe the way I perceive Rage Against the Machine and a few others might be the exception in terms of, like, we'll actually see you with a shovel and a pick and being involved. But many people don't often see that as much. They see the art and then they live through that.
I think that a distinction needs to be made with regards to movements. I think that a real difference in you know, movements connected to art have to do with whether those movements have an analysis that says that we need to change the system, right? If there are movements, you know, if there are movements that basically just say we need another form, we need, you know, more black capitalism, or we need to just we need to make this system a little more fair, then things are very vague even for those that are involved in it. So, you know, for instance, when I came out on the same compilation with folks that are considered gangster rappers, like Spice One and, you know, 187 Faculty and all those folks. And those were my friends. And a lot of times they would say to me, you know what, we're doing, you know, I'm doing the same thing as you. I'm dropping that science. And, you know, these are folks with songs like Kill 'Em, Murder, Murder, and all this stuff. And what they were saying is, in what they felt like they were explaining to people how to survive in capitalism. They felt like they were explaining to people, like, how you survive is to sell dope, and here are the instructions for doing that. So they felt like they were part of this thing. Now, we see that as not being part of a movement. You know, Ice Cube probably sees his development of a multi-million dollar film company as part of that same movement that he was involved in. So I think the difference is there's a difference that comes with art that attempts to build a movement that destroys capitalism. So,
well, then let's build off that point. You said that, you know, that there are people that would, at the end of the day, advocate more black capitalism or just capitalism in general, be a part of the system and, you know, and see if you can get yours before everybody gets you, et cetera, et cetera. But that still is a movement in itself, because many people will follow that. And this goes back to what I'm saying. If you have government saying, let me place particular pieces of art in front of people, whether it's reality TV or whether it's a particular artist that becomes symbolic, like in this point in time, Jay-Z and Kanye become very symbolic. They hang out with the president, and their songs seem to reflect more about how you can get money in the middle of a recession than it does how you can turn that around. With that being said, then that is a movement. So then it comes back to,
if they're being true to that movement,
then how does this movement or people in this room that feel that they are directly opposed to what's going on, how do you become competitive to that movement in terms of reaching an audience that's sitting around and going, I see you, but I see them. Let me follow this lead, you know, at the very least. Or do we need to be in competition with that?
Well, the truth is, we're in competition with that idea. We're saying that the people should control the wealth that they create. And I think that it's not a competition between the artists.
No.
I think that it's a competition between what kind of a movement are we making that talks about changing people's lives for real. I mean, people listen to Jay-Z and they think that's freedom. Why? Because he's somebody that doesn't have to worry about paying the bills. And that's what we're fighting for, right? But we don't necessarily always put it that way because it's not spelling out exactly what color the money will be after the revolution. But that's what the impetus behind that movement, behind people being involved in that movement,
right,
is the same thing that we're involved, that we're fighting for, which is people having some freedom of movement in their life, some control of their time, and you know, and that's what that's actually what they're advertising, but they're just saying you can get it through, you know, through.
But they also have have a Wall Street backing that finds that what you and people in this room are talking about to be threatening. They look and they go, we don't need more overflow rooms of people trying to hear all this information. So let's redirect everybody who's outside this room to look another way. Let's make sure they tune in to a KML before they go to a KPFA. Listen to a JV and his money songs before you listen to Boots and his anti-capitalism song. And at the end of the day, we wind up with situations where you may have people voting against or acting against their very interests. You have folks that say, fuck unions, we don't need them, you know. I don't want to get involved with the struggle. I just want to get my money and move on. These types of ideology, I don't want to be in an organization. I just want to get mine and think individualistically versus, you know, together. So it seems like, as you said, we're at this point now. Social media, access to information, people understanding that, you know, with a couple of tweaks and turns, you know, you can really light a fire under people and all of a sudden folks are at your doorstep challenging things. How do we take this group of people, and I'll just define it for the sake of the question, as a movement, and make them become the center, the thing that folks center on versus the corporate type of stuff that is competing for that same mindset? Mm-hmm.
It's called Occupy Oakland.
Right.
And really that's the thing that, or Occupy Wall Street movement, all that. Really that's what was good about that. There is no membership to any of that movement. All it is the left working together. And that's what that movement means. It's finally the left stops fighting each other and, you know, sits in a room with people they hate and makes a movement happen. And then all of a sudden there's attention and excitement and imagination around something that could really happen. One of the worst compliments I would ever get, like in the early 90s, was, because we were on BET and MTV and stuff like that, and sometimes people would come to me and say, I really like your music, but, you know, I need to listen to some of that real shit. And what they meant by real shit was the stuff that sometimes might get classified as gangster rap. Because, why? Because that's talking about something that they could do. Like I was saying, you could do these things and hustle and make some money. There was no movement that was real for them to be involved in. Like, so talking about changing the system was not real. It was what you know, it was nice and interesting, but it was not real. Throughout, you know, in high school, I was known that I was a communist. That was never a problem because people were just like, okay, communist, cool, whatever. You know, like, it was not here nor there for them because it wasn't real. It wasn't something that was worth even debating over. And now, you know, the Occupy Wall Street movement has put it out there as a viable possibility that there could be a movement that changes the system. And to the point where at least people have to argue about whether they agree with it or not. Before that, people don't even think it didn't even think it was worth arguing about whether they agreed with it or not.
The question would become, is the Occupy movement limited in terms of we have a bunch of people who have a political understanding that get it, and then may sit in the room and work together where they hadn't worked together before? Or are we talking about a larger potential movement of people that might be sitting at my church that don't know nothing about Occupy Wall Street movement until it shows up on ABC or CBS or Fox or CNN? And then they become informed, and then people feel like, okay, I can say 99 versus 1%, think they're part of a movement. And then when it disappears off those news channels with a very deliberate, as a very deliberate strategy, then it disappears. And you got people going, well, the Wall Street movement is over. You know, even though people may say, no, there's still meetings going on. So the point that I'm getting at is that if we know that that's the game, and celebrity and visibility and being in these corporate-owned spaces is a currency that the masses kind of respond to, as a movement, as a tactic, do we have a responsibility to either create an institution that is just as compelling and just as attractive, or do you have strategies to hijack? You know, does Boots do a radio song where he could just say, fuck capitalism at the end of the day and reach the millions and people follow up because you finally got that audience? Or do you do something different?
Well,
did the question make sense? I'm sorry if I rambled. Did it make sense what I was asking? Okay.
I think that the way that we circumvent what the mass media, the hold that mass media has on the public, is we go to those public spaces, you know. So, for instance, ABC and NBC News can put a story about the Occupy Wall Street movement, but there are so many people in the movement that we could have all the spaces that people pass by every day telling people the real story about it. It's not something that's hard. Well, the organizing it is hard to do, but it's not
really
something that we can't do. I would say, though, that as far as what you were saying before about it just being the left in meetings with each other, we've done a lot of canvassing in the Occupy Oakland Foreclosure Defense Group, and we're starting to do that with the fast food workers thing. And people, there are so many people that have never been to Oscar Grant Plaza that feel like they're in the movement, right? So, handing out flyers like at shopping centers, and somebody's like, "Oh yeah, I'm part of this. My pastor, you know, said that, you know, blah blah blah." So there are people that feel like they're in the movement that we don't necessarily see. So I don't think that it's confined to the folks that actually show up at the meetings, because even some of the folks that do say they're in Occupy Oakland that we see it, some things aren't coming to the GAs or anything like that. So we can't define it that way. I think that it is wrong to rely on the mass media, but I think that we have the potential for mass media ourselves without trying to recreate our own news shows,
right,
or our own. I think that we got to go back to some basics, which are like out in public spaces and art that takes control of that.
Mass media, and that becomes the scary part, which is why you, in my opinion, you see it often, these very deliberate and very forceful attempts to control it because of the potential. I mean, it's no accident that police organizations all over the country were very clear that when Fuck the Police came out, they were making sure that wherever those venues were, that they had jurisdiction over, including Mountain View and others, that they were like, these artists cannot do the song, period, end of story. And in many places they couldn't, and in a few places that they did, you know, they approached those artists and they approached those venues and tried to shut it down. So somebody, they understood that was a very powerful thing. We've seen the type of clamping down on art in terms of radio play. You know, we talk about, okay, I get it that mass media, we might not listen to the masses, but if we don't, then why are they censoring things? Why are they, you know, when Jadakiss says Bush knocks down the towers, he can say nigger and bitch in a song, but they bleep out the the Bush reference of knocking down the towers and remove that. You know, when Kanye does his songs, he says all sorts of things, but when he says the white man is the reason that we have some of these pathological conditions in New York, where he's from, or where, not where he's from, but where his label's based, on Hot 97, where you can tune it in and air, the DJs will say, will use expletives. They're removing that word. They're bleeping it. You know, the white man, they beep it out. So to me, it says that people have sat in a room and understood that if we allow people to get comfortable with certain ideology or certain thoughts, it's going to wake up the masses. So they shut it down before it starts. And which brings me back to this question again. If that is happening, then do we have a response to that?
No, I think that the only response is you build a movement, you'll create the artists. You won't have to worry about getting the coup on the air because some kid that's 12 years old right now that we moved their family back into their foreclosed home, in 8 years they'll be making music, right? And you'll have a movement that creates the art. And, you know, it's a lot of times people, you know, pose the question of whether a movement needs art. But I think that the answer is yes, but art also needs a movement to be relevant. You know, there's so many, you know, if you just want to talk about music, there's so many folks making music that their audience doesn't feel, because they're very disconnected. They're not involved in anything. But art needs, you know, needs a movement. In Oakland, so many people made songs when the Oscar Grant movement happened. And it wasn't just folks being opportunists. It was, they got inspired. People have been doing that in Oakland, around Occupy Oakland. People that never were associated with making songs about a movement. I think that maybe we haven't been, you know, just locally here, we haven't been as quick to capitalize on that and put that and promote that music to the
That seems like a detriment.
Yeah,
it seems
definitely.
Like well, it seems like if we're going to have
you're right, but we're still getting a lot of stuff together.
Right.
And but I'm saying, so as we do more music, as we do more movement, the music and the art will come. You know, it's not like we don't need to first promote the art. And I think that that's happened, like, since the 90s, once there became, like, this trend, like, where groups were like, we need to use hip-hop to organize for social justice. And then it kind of became like the cart was put before the horse. And it was all about promoting music that was conscious. And a lot of really good kids that were good artists got involved in some of those programs and made songs. But even they were like, okay, there's nothing to attach this to, you know? And the point is that that just promoting the art still leaves a big gap between what people really want from the songs is connection to a movement.
Right.
And we need to be spending our time making a movement.
Cedric Muhammad is the owner of a well-known site called blackelectric.com. He's also a former road manager for Wu-Tang Clan, and he works behind the scenes with a lot of artists. And Cedric, over the years, has been very deliberate in terms of challenging movements about their connection with artists. Oftentimes, we get into rooms, and not necessarily this room, because I think it's a little bit more sophisticated, but we get into a lot of discussions where, you know, we'll have these panel discussions and folks will say, if only 50 Cent and if only Wu-Tang would do these type of songs, if only these comedians would say these type of jokes. And his thing was like, you have a responsibility to have a relationship with those artists. And so as a strategy, one of the things that I've seen him do is find out, you know, how are you going to get in a room, sit down so that everybody has a good education about what you as an artist do, and that artist has a very good familiarity and education about what your movement is about. if for any reason, just in case somebody puts a mic in front of them, which they often do, and goes, you know, what do you think of this? And you don't want some uninformed person who has celebrity to define, you know, you as a group of people. You know, if women in the room are sitting here with a war on women and Paris Hilton becomes the spokesperson on the evening news, it can have some far-reaching effects. You know, when, you know, somebody goes on Fox News doing an Oscar Grant thing and you've got a million people watching and they say, no, the police aren't bad in Oakland, that kind of messes things up for a lot of things. So as a strategy, he was saying that we have to have these type of relationships. Where, you know, we call it political education, familiarity, so everybody knows what's going on, at least in terms of the movement. As artists, should there not be a certain set of standards? Should there not be a meeting in the room? Should there be a meeting where people come together and go, okay, here are some key points you need to know about capitalism. What's its evils? What's its good points or whatever? Here's some things you need to know about a particular movement so it doesn't get misled or misdefined by the enhancement of celebrity.
If to get anyone involved in the movement, all it took was a meeting in a room, you know, we'd have a gigantic movement already and things. But that's not, it doesn't work that way. People get involved in something that they see having viability and being a movement. Mr. Fab and Too Short wanted to be involved in the November 2nd strike. Why? Because it was big. And they saw that it was possible to happen. And Mr. Fab went and said some very useful things on like Channel 4,
right,
because he came and he was part of it. You know, you said,
but somebody had to inform him, otherwise he could have went there and said something.
But it wasn't only informing,
right?
Because folks are, you know, people have their own political views, and so you could have a meeting with as many artists as you want. But if there's no movement for them to attach to, those ideas are gonna, you know, they're not gonna be real to them. And artists are just like any other people. You gotta get folks involved in a struggle in order to get them on your side.
How do we get people involved in a struggle?
You make sure that we're struggling around things that matter to them and things that they feel that we can win and change.
We're going to get ready to take some questions in a second. Let me just ask you this, and we'll start to open it up. Over the years, you've been involved with many things that have involved art and politics and the whole thing, starting with the Mau Mau Rhythm Collective and, you know, and gosh, I forget the book club that y'all were doing for a while. What was the book club thing? Communist Book Club? What was it called?
Young Comrades.
Young Comrades.
It wasn't just a book club.
Yeah.
They turned into that.
Yeah. And they used, and long before, you know, Occupy was disrupting City Hall, they was doing that, you know. And then, of course, with Street Sweeper Social and the coup. What have been the pitfalls? What have been the best practices that you would pass along to folks for those movements or just the involvements with different groups in terms of, you know, these things work, these things really help build momentum. These were some mistakes that we made that we, like, wouldn't do that again.
I mean, wow, that's a whole separate conversation in and of itself.
Well, you got 30 seconds.
And one thing that I think that I think was something that worked in the past when we had the Young Comrades for a very short time that I saw happening with Occupy Oakland is that one time we did, you know, that at the lake in Oakland there was always a conflict, right? Every year in the summertime, the folks that lived around the lake got scared of the people of color that came to hang out at the lake. There's actually even a documentary called Claiming Open Spaces, and that was made in the mid-70s about the lake. And so people were tired of, you know, being messed with by the police. They made the lake into a no cruising zone, but at the same time it was a scenic route. And they were towing people's cars for going around the lake more than once. So we had a campaign to stop the no cruising ordinance there, and But the thing is, because that was an issue, and this is, everyone knows this, that's trying to be an organizer, you find the right issue that there's some leverage around, that it takes people coming together for, and that can work. And what happened there was that people considered it their struggle. You know, we went for the follow-up thing. That was Fuck the Police Day at the lake. And the follow-up thing was Who Ride at the City Council. And when we went to the follow-up thing, everybody started talking about criticisms and self-criticisms of what happened at Fuck the Police Day. But people were like, next time we need to do this. Next time we should do this. And what we did wrong. But people talked about it in the term of we. That they didn't feel like there was, in that particular campaign, that there was some small group of people that had the answer. They felt like, you know, it was them, and the mistakes that happened were them. And I think that that's one of the good things that came out of Occupy Oakland, is that, you know, because of the chaos, it was clear that there was nobody in charge, and that everybody could have some say in it. And people, even though on the media had certain folks from the community feeling like saying that they felt separated from it, a lot of folks felt like there was power in that, and that they could, that it was something of them. I can't say whether that's how people still feel, but at a certain point, that definitely is how people felt. And I think that's what we want to go for, is people feeling like it's their movement. And some of what needs to be cut out in order for that to happen is some of us who feel like we know the exact correct path for revolution need to just be quiet and let it be a little bit incorrect and it'd be a larger movement.
Well, expand on that a little. What do you mean by that?
Well, I'm saying you can have I think the legacy of the left since the 50s, maybe before that, but definitely since the 50s, has been to break up into smaller and smaller, more correct groups. And there are a lot of very correct three-person organizations. And what that comes from, it's not that there shouldn't be political struggle and there shouldn't be debate and theory and things like that, but it's the tenor with which we've started to address each other, right? And that tenor is one that says, where you are is not revolutionary enough. Where you are right now is not going to be what makes this movement happen. And the truth is, probably by the time this movement gets large enough to actually be able to affect this system in a large way, none of these organizations will exist in the form that they exist right now. Things will have gone through so many changes that, you know, it doesn't matter that this person's in a nonprofit and that person's in a union, you know, right now. All those folks will be in different organizations if we're alive by the time that happens. So the point is that there's a lot of dogmatic sectarianism that's going on that has really split things up. And it's not even political. It's people are falling off and splitting up because of personality shit. It's, you know, and we all knew that we disagreed with each other when it started. But it's just the culture that has happened with people, you know, people criticizing each other in a way that's kind of like high school, and where people are talking shit behind each other's backs and giving each other funny vibes, and really it shouldn't be that little, but that's what it is. That sort of thing, and people don't want to come around you.
And some of it is quite deliberate, you know, and I mean, that's a tactic as well. It sounds like what you're saying is that there needs to be a certain type of revolution in terms of thinking in the mind. In terms of, like, if I disagree with you, does that mean I can't talk with you, can't work with you,
yeah.
you know, or do I have to form a three-person group, you know, I'm Davey D., who doesn't like Boots, and Boots is another group, and, you know, that sort of thing,
mm-hmm.
versus can we find commonality in, you know, even if we have disagreements on 4 out of the 10 points.
Mm-hmm. And I think that everyone could theoretically agree with what you're saying, and it's just that because many people are so afraid of, like, the idea that of the discipline that comes with being in an organization, that we've run away from just certain ethics of conduct and criticism, self-criticism, and it just turns into a lot of bullshit that people would, I mean, everybody would rather be doing what they were doing already. Everybody, you know, everybody would rather do, because that was their comfort zone. And so you give people enough reason to not come, they're going to not come. And, you know, so I think that that's something that we can address and change in the months to come that will allow us to keep growing.
I think we're going to open up for questions. How are we going to do this?
Well, okay, before we do that, we're going to have a quick...
So I'm just going to take a couple minutes to explain kind of the fundraiser that's happening today. I want to start by saying that we're living in momentous times. It was just 15 or 16 months ago that the people of Tunisia and Egypt kicked off a wave of revolutions that toppled decades-long dictatorships and inspired revolts the world over. But today, this very weekend, the Egyptian revolution is facing its greatest threat yet from a counter-revolutionary coup conducted by the Supreme Council of the Armed Forces in the midst of the presidential election this weekend. The people of Greece tomorrow vote on, who by the way have waged a mass struggle against austerity for years now, tomorrow they vote on whether to back Syriza and reject austerity or whether to cow and be cowed by the threats of the European elites to kick Greece out of the euro and destroy their economy. That's what's on the agenda in Greece. The debt crisis in Europe is now snaking its hands around Italy and Spain, which is a threat to the entire world economy. And here in the US, though we have a long ways to go in terms of building a resistance, we saw the beginnings, the first stage, the first gatherings of our fight back in the Occupy movement. And, I mean, even more recently, we've seen the beginnings of a more broad-based fight back against the racist murders of Trayvon Martin, or Alan Bluford, and now Derek Gaines. The Socialism 2012 conference in Chicago is a key venue for linking those kinds of struggles, the struggles here, with international and national struggles. Revolutionaries from Greece will be there, including, in fact, someone from Syriza is going to be there. Revolutionaries from Egypt will be there, sharing their experiences. Boots Riley will be there. The parents of Alan Bluford, who was murdered by the Oakland PD, are going to be there. David McNally, a Marxist economist who has one of the best explanations for the current crisis of capitalism, is going to be there. It's all about theory, debate, and practical application to struggle. So we're trying to get as many people from the Bay Area as possible to go to the conference and contribute to the building of a revolutionary left here and internationally that can say that another world is possible and that we can fight for it. And we're asking you all to contribute to the Bay Area Scholarship Fund to get people there. If you're interested in going, please do come and talk to the people out front with the Socialism 2012 conference table. So I know many people have already kind of pitched in the door, and these are tough times for folks, so, you know, that's a real constraint on everyone. But if you miss a door, or if you feel like you can pitch in more, if you're in that kind of a position, please do dig deeply. Thank you very much.
Okay, so we're going to go ahead and open it up for questioning. I'll take a list of names, not names, actually, probably outfits. So if you want to raise your hand and get on the list, then I'll write your name down, and then we'll go through a few questions and have them answer and then do a few more questions. There's a good chance we won't get to all of the questions in the room, so just to say that here from the front. So Let's see, I see a few hands already. Okay, why don't you go ahead and do your question while I write down the vote.
Can it be sort of a statement making, I don't know, it's not like exactly a question, but I wanted to sort of talk about the art thing because I'm from a family where my parents were communists in the 30s and part of the union movement, 34 General Strike and stuff like that, but they didn't want to tell us because of the McCarthy era. But we had music all the time. We had Paul Robeson, we had Woody Guthrie, and we had all the singers. So it made all of us socialists in the family, even though we didn't. They never talked about it because they were afraid. Okay. So I mean, it's really important. And I wanted to say that I heard something on TV recently from Occupy Wall Street. They're making comic books, and I think comic books are really important to tell. Tell a story of the 34 General Strike in a comic book. Give it to kids, give it to people so they'll learn. You know, there are books out there. I'm going to try to do some of those myself. I'm not an artist, but kind of person who can draw these people, you know. And I just sort of wonder what you guys think about it, because I think, you know, art and music are extremely important. That's what makes people change. All the talk doesn't mean anything. It's the music and the art that gets to them.
I definitely think culture is very important, and I think that there are, as far as the visual forms of art, like comic books and stuff, I'm really excited about a lot of things that I see popping up like that, and hopefully, you know, those things are hard to do, but hopefully, you know, somebody can figure out a way to distribute some radical comic books.
You know, when I was coming up, the way I learned about Black history, there was a series of comic books that came up, you know, Harriet Tubman and all these people, they put in there. It was very interesting because this was in the 70s, at the time when, I remember this, when they were starting to demonize art in many ways. They were, you know, there was a whole thing about comic books ain't good for you, you shouldn't really be reading them. And, you know, you don't think about it when you're 6, 7, 8 years old, but you think later, it's like, wow, I haven't seen those comic books since. You see what I'm saying? And I wonder if it's because people had the bright idea to start informing folks in a currency that they could relate to. Because at that time, everybody was collecting Spider-Man and Superman and all that other stuff. And over the years, I've seen the demonization of particular types of art or particular types of artists when I feel that they have the potential, if not, having impact on folks. And I think that's something that needs to be looked at. During the Afrocentric period of the late 80s, early 90s, there was so much going on, whether it was Spike Lee doing movies, whether it was the Public Enemies and the KRS-Ones. But when you go back and look at those videos, which, you know, aren't always easy to get, you notice a few things that were going on. You had people that were together. Everybody was showing their entire neighborhood. There were more than a few videos where people were attacking the police and chasing them. And you don't see that nowadays. Just simple things like that. I'm more likely to see the police whooping on somebody than I am to see somebody who's like, I'm going to do a video where I chase the police, you know? Well, just something like that. And
there's a definite censorship around that.
Yeah.
You know, they had all the video companies at one point in the 90s. You know, it used to be that people would have guns and all that sort of stuff. But on the premise that they wanted to get the guns out of videos, they started politically censoring videos. So certain time, we have a video where, you know, we're throwing the mayor's body in the lake. They wouldn't let that happen. They wouldn't let that. I mean, but, you know, they would let, if it wasn't the mayor, I mean, they
right.
said
you
that
we
could do
lake,
it, you
be
know,
cool.
We could do that. We had one where we were just redistributing stuff from Rockefeller's house. They said that if it was a black guy, then they would let it happen. And this was like, so
what year
there
was
that was 94. So and so they made a clear, I mean, they were clear about it that at one point they sent us a message that said about one of our videos that this video are, you know, people are worried at the station. This was BET. We're worried that this will cause unrest in the streets.
Well, the turning point to that was Public Enemy when they did the video, By the Time I Get to Arizona. And many of the languages that's used against gangster rap was used on them. I remember having to do TV shows where they were saying the group was irresponsible. And for people who don't know the video, they killed two senators. One they poisoned a senator, and the other one they blow up his car because they wouldn't, you know, approve of the Martin Luther King holiday. And, you know, you don't think about it at the time. It was like, of course, this is public enemy. It's what they do. But it was a really big deal. But then afterwards, you know, I know MTV was doing stuff like, you said they would, somebody would burn a flag. I think Paris or somebody burnt a flag. They said you can't put that in. No, Brand Nubians did. Paris did a song where he put Axl Rose next to Tom Metzger of the Aryan Nation, and they made him remove that from the videos. And so what it was is that these entities got everybody moving from this outlet to this mainstream outlet. And then once everybody got hooked, then they started changing the rules, like, okay, soften it up. You know, put some girls in there, get rid of the black women, put some white women there if you're a black artist, those types of things, and then dumbed it down. And I think they clearly understood that imagery and certain types of messaging could have a long impact if left unchecked.
Okay. So I have the person in the gray shirt here, followed by a woman with the curly hair on the left, right there. Yes. Oh, I'm sorry. Yes. You, Andrew, sorry.
Good to see you again. You know, the biggest division in the Occupy movement, particularly in Oakland, you know, seems to be those people who want diversity of tactics, which, of course, is euphemism for vandalism, property destruction, and those who want diversity of people at this time. And I've been one of those who, at this time, want diversity of people in the movement. And as some of you know, I've written an article that appeared at davyd.com called The Activism Entry Point. And you can find that by either going to David D's website or just Googling The Activism Entry Point in WordPress, for the WordPress version of that, where Boots and I also have an amiable and collegial exchange. So my question about this is that my article, The Activism Entry Point, it postulated that at this particular time we cannot have a diversity of tactics, meaning violence, and a diversity of people at the same time. And I myself, as being part of this split on the diversity of people side, have distanced myself from Occupy Oakland because I personally feel that where I am as a black male and the position I'm in, you know, with my job and everything else, I don't want to trust myself. I don't want to trust my well-being and safety to people who believe that at this time we should have a diversity of tactics. Because, as I've mentioned before, I don't want to get arrested over any bullshit. I've been arrested before, and I don't mind being arrested for a good reason, like the Oscar Grant March where I was arrested. But I don't want to be arrested over any bullshit. So what I've found out before, during, and after the Occupy movement, particularly in Oakland, here's where my question comes in, is that some people do not want to have a diversity of people. There are some ideologues who are pro the diversity of tactics euphemisms who say, no, we don't care about a broad mass movement. Ideologically, we want, you know, what they see as a small fraction of people who are into, you know, vandalism, property damage, however you want to call diversity of tactics, because these are going to be the true blue people. And the rest of you all, even if, like myself, I'm not a pacifist and I don't believe in absolute nonviolence, I support the Palestinian armed struggle, I support the Iraqi anti-imperialist armed struggle, so I'm not a pacifist by any means, but I'm about building a broad-based movement at this time, and I'm wondering what you have to say, if you've heard it or however you want to comment on it, on those people who believe that unless you're that tiny percentage who's down for the revolution, and down for revolution means diversity of tactics, then you ain't shit. We don't want all you people anyway. We're the ones who are going to do the revolution.
Okay. Thank you. And Andrew? Yeah, but we're going to take a couple. Yeah. So, Andrew, go ahead.
One of the things that I feel is like one of the problems I have, like, it's like, why don't we, you know, pay attention more to our own community? Why don't we, like, you know, work on the community rather than, like, think about, like, you know, this, I don't know, this general, like, idea of, like, activism and things like that. Like, just, like, I mean, there's so many things that, like, aren't being done just because we're trying to be in solidarity with so many things all the time. And I think that a lot of times we just lose our footing, we lose the grounding that, like, the reason why we're activists, you know, like, because we're too busy, like, you know, trying to be in solidarity with, like, 5,000 different causes and stuff, rather than, like, you know, thinking about, like, okay, we need to get these people over to the school and take it over so we can get close. Things like that. It's like, you know, it's like that all our attention is just being, like, skillfully, like, you know, pointed in so many directions. And it's, I sit in a lot of meetings and we're all talking about, oh, we need to vote on being in solidarity with this person. We need to be in solidarity with this person. We spend, like, 30 minutes, like, arguing about something that we all would agree on in 10 seconds. And it's just, like, we have so many issues with that. And additionally, like, I like the point about, like, we do need a movement, like, for people to plug into and, like, for people to, like, feel confident. The thing is, like, you know, it's all, like, one of the things that I think is really important is, like, you know, this argument over diversity of tactics. The thing is, like, the question is, like, you know, it's not tactics. So the thing is, like, if you're going to try and fight a war, if you're going to try and use some sort of violence, like, in your toolbox of activism, use it. Like, the thing is, like, nobody seems to have, like, you know, the organizational structure to be successful. So it's like, I mean, the thing is, it's not even, I'm staring around.
All right. Do you want to go back to this question?
I would say that, you know, I haven't run into someone that has the philosophy that you were saying that we don't want to be. I'm not saying they're not out there. I haven't run into anyone. I haven't had that debate where someone says, I don't want to build a mass movement. And, you know, and there are.
For those who are clapping, that does not deny my experience, just like I'm not denying the group's experience.
So I can't argue about that philosophy. I would say that, but in relation to that idea, I know a lot of people in Occupy Oakland that don't think that. So I wouldn't gauge how we approach this debate by those couple people. Now, there are a lot of, you know, your question was, what would I say to those folks? Obviously, the idea of Occupy Oakland and Occupy Wall Street movement is to create a mass movement. And as I said before, we've been in, as far as most people in the U.S., we were in the movement, quote unquote, was invisible. So obviously, we want to get people involved at the level that they're at. And anything, you know, what I will say is that part of the division and people not being willing to work together does come out in this idea that, you know, okay, we're our own little group and we don't have to answer to anyone else and we don't have to work with anyone else and where folks are at. That's a problem. Also is a problem is saying, like, there's a small group of people in a large movement that have made me not be involved, right? The question is, what point are we at historically? We're at a point where if you're going to let 3 people, 4 or 5 people make you not be involved in a movement that has the most revolutionary potential that we've seen in the last 50 years, then that's a shame.
Well, it's not just 3 in my case, Cruz. I respect you and I admire you a great deal, but I've come across more than 3 or 4 or 5.
Okay,
10,
well,
12,
well, I would say,
20.
So you, you know, what small percentage of folks, you know, that's what I'm saying. That doesn't, I'm not at all saying that the issue that you're saying, that you're talking about, shouldn't be talked about and debated, because it should. But coming at it from the standpoint of, I'm not involved because these few people are involved, I bet you that the few people that are involved, the reason I haven't talked to them, that I don't know them, is because they're not involved in everything, right? And you could go through any movement, and if it's large enough, there's going to be people in it that you disagree with and think are taking the wrong path. And that the reason that we have people that we disagree with and are taking the wrong path is because the movement is large. You know, if we want to, you know, if the idea is that we got to figure out that one point before we can move on, then we're making a catch-22 that says we can't get on with our work, right? That, and I'm not saying that, you know, you write some essays and you publish them. I think that's good. But the question is at what point are you involved? Are you involved with things? At what point do you stop yourself from being involved in a movement? And I don't think that, I think that you're doing a disservice to do that from outside the movement, right?
Well, Occupy Oakland isn't the entire movement.
No, I'm talking about the movement in which we're talking about.
Let me hit him in the back for a second. You were talking about one of the things that you said was looking towards celebrity, so to speak, versus ourselves. And just my experience, and for people who don't know, I've worked in management for some of these big radio companies for a long time. KML, and then programming for Time Warner, 14 and 15 stations. So I had the privilege of sitting in rooms and seeing how people do focus groups, spend millions of dollars to get into people's mindsets, breaking it down by demographics, oftentimes so they can go to a sales team and go, white women between 18 and 34 think this way. Black males, 10 to 15, think this way. You know, very sophisticated, very strategic type of things. And one of the things that I noticed over the years is that they moved away from highlighting art and letting the artist be the draw to their product to letting the institution become the draw to the product. So in 2012, it's such a fast food type of scenario that most people can't remember who the big artists were that they were listening to eight times a day on their favorite radio station. And that's not by accident, it's by design. And I usually do this experiment with my class. I would often ask them, name the top 10 artists. They could do it if you ask them to do it for the last 6 months. By the time you get to 2 or 3 years outside of this particular year, they can barely name one or two. I've done this with industry people that promote artists, and they can't barely remember. And so what I'm getting at is that there are many people that have figured out ways to get into the masses' heads and literally program folks to become accustomed to entities, corporate entities that present information. And so many times we have to remind ourselves to not get caught up in validating our information or even experiences based upon what is shown on a CNN or a BET or whatever. And so what you're talking about, where we start to be like, well, can Jay-Z do it versus Boots, is a deliberate type of pushing folks in a direction where they go, I'm going to look towards the celebrity and not towards my neighbor. And all of us fall victim to that at various points in time, and it's something that I would say that we have to constantly be struggling against. For example, you got Dave here from Indie Bay. You know, that's an institution, in my opinion. But when we wake up in the morning, do we look at the Chronicle or the Tribune or the Times or the Post before we go to Indie Bay to get our news? Or are we thinking like, well, that's the alternative thing. That's not the real thing. I need to get it, you know, from some corporate institution that has spent millions of dollars to make themselves seem to be the be-all, end-all. I would suggest that we have to challenge ourselves and redirect our thinking. And not only that, but also talk up those other entities and outlets that do right by us versus the other way around. Is this making sense, what I'm saying? You know? And so I think that's going to be an ongoing challenge. And even if it doesn't impact us in this room, come to some of my classes, even on a college level, and you see where that impact is really sharp, where you can have things like even Occupy going on, and it's like it disappears once it goes off the TV, because it's like, I seen it on Channel 4, I heard the talking points, and they run with that. And you really have to massage them to think something different unless they have had those experiences. And that's just going to be something that, you know, that's part of their arsenal in terms of keeping the masses in a particular point of position, is to fuck with our minds using mass media as a very potent weapon. So that's something I think we should think about.
Okay. So
I also, what you were talking about, the question of, like, working around community issues as opposed to larger macroeconomic issues and uniting with someone's political stance. I mean, I think that that's a balancing act that we always need to do and be aware of and make sure that we're involved in, you know, in organizing folks where they are. As far as your statement about we should be going and occupying a school, that's happening right now.
Yeah, Lakeview.
At Lakeview. So I just want to, because I actually didn't. Part of what I've seen happening with the whole Occupy movement and it kind of people kind of going into their own ways is that, you know, now there are people in certain parts of the movement that don't know what the other parts are doing, because I didn't know about that until yesterday. And so I think that to regain some of that momentum, you know, and with that, it's known there are issues around people's involvement with the Occupy movement or how they want to be associated with that. But because of that, our demonstrations, our actions are smaller than they were just a couple months ago, because we're kind of going into our old factionalism and not wanting to be associated with this group or that group or whatever. But it's something that can be easily remedied.
Okay, so I have a person up here on stage followed by the gentleman in the light blue shirt.
So my question is actually kind of related to what you were just discussing about that balancing act between acting at a local level and like showing solidarity at a national or international level. And earlier today, there was like an ISO-organized protest in solidarity with the Egyptians and what's happening there this weekend. And it started at noon, and by the time I could only get there at 12:30, it was already over. And it was, you know, that's just the nature of things. Like, I guess there were very few people there, and it wasn't able to pick up. But there was even, I was just wondering, maybe broadly, if you could talk about people in Occupy Oakland was, like, in Oscar Grant and, like, really at its height, how it's defined its relationship to, like, the Arab Spring in particular, but also to, you know, austerity, and how we can keep that solidarity going while also recognizing that people are sort of, like, splintering out and, you know, the local actions and the school occupations are probably more tangible to folks in terms of like what you were talking about before, in terms of art that like has a piece that you can attach to or a message that you can do something about. So where's
that? Yeah, I have an idea around how that could be done. Is the, you know, tying the actual campaigns that we're doing to the things that we have solidarity with, right? As opposed to necessarily separate actions, because then it makes it more meaningful, right? So and that also concentrates our efforts. So that's a possible question. But as far as how it was done, there's probably people in this room that could answer that question a lot better than I could have. You know.
Can I come in on that?
Hold on a second. I have a list going, but I can put you on the.
It's very important.
Can we give everybody's way?
It's just important what everyone says, so I'm going to have to stick to the list.
So can you?
Sorry about that.
Can I have a?
Yeah, got you on there.
Okay.
Yeah. That's okay.
Okay. I think that we have a need to, in explaining the system, to you know the folks that are listening to. talk about things that are happening in other countries and our relationship to those things. And I think that by tying it to the actions and the campaigns that we have here, we might do that even better so that people don't feel like this is something abstract and, you know, the folks are passing by or they're talking about something going on in Egypt and that's nice and that's interesting. But if we have, you know, if we talk about austerity measures closing down Lakeview School and we make sure that we're making that connection there with the global economy, then it might even be more effective. But, you know, that's just an idea. But yeah. Leo over there could probably tell you more about what we've done in the past.
I think this is a good moment to announce that we are having a reception after this, so there will be tons of time to talk to people around you. I mean, this is a room full of activists, and so we have a million things to talk about. So I apologize. You know, I know everybody wants to speak, so I really apologize for having to cut people off. So I have the person in the blue shirt followed by the person in the white shirt. Go ahead.
I'm a library user advocate, and there's a wonderful, actually a musical mural, at least the front part, on Bernalites Branch Library, which features Victor Jara, Holly Gear, with words in English and Spanish from them, and a figure that's like Roberta Flack, and that's the main mural at the front. On the side is a panel honoring working women. On the back is the neighborhood history. It was created through a community effort. Gay muralist led the effort, Arch Williams, who was a Haight-Ashbury muralist known for, among other things, Educate to Liberate. And this is a thing that the city, led by the library, or ostensibly by the library, basically has plans to completely paint out and replace with a very bland and sanitized product. So my group is working on trying to save that mural. We've just gotten a 90-day reprieve because in their haste to destroy it, they neglected to follow the California Art Preservation Act, which requires that a fine art work artist be given 90 days notice before the art is destroyed, and they just simply forgot or didn't bother to notify the heir and personal representative of Arch Williams. What's amazing to me is that the whole discussion, multiple sessions of the Art Commission and the Library Commission, never mentioned Victor Jara or any of the specific contents of the mural itself. And all the politics, Victor Jara was a friend of Allende, a singer-songwriter, who was arrested when Pinochet took over in 9/11/73. The stadium where they threw him and thousands of people is named after Victor Jara now. When he played protest songs, they broke his hands, and when he continued, they killed him. So all of the politics and all of the content, what's amazing to me, in addition to what they're doing, is that the process never, there was never a single word discussed about what the contents are of the old, and what specific contents would be honored in the supposedly new mural. So, you know, this touches on poor coverage, by the press, and music and art, and a number of other things. But anyway, I've got literature if anybody's interested, but I'm interested in how these sorts of things happen. And I think things happen, this erasure of memory also. It just happens quietly, and good things are taken away, and people don't even realize what's happened in their own neighborhood.
Okay, good question. Yes, go ahead.
Okay, so I just wanted to state that I agree that art and revolution are inherently interlinked with one another. I believe that a key aspect of building a movement with the hopes of building a revolution, essentially, is creating a culture of resistance where any average Joe who's walking down the street, they don't know what they're doing with themselves if they're not part of the movement and not part of the resistance, and part of making that happen is about just making the idea of mobilization ubiquitous, you know, and art is obviously a huge part of that. We all are exposed to art on a day everywhere we go, or there's an opportunity to be exposed to art when you're walking down the street, but anytime you talk to another individual, whatever, all the time. So my question is more, it's more of a creative question, I guess. Do you think other artistic mediums that could be used by Occupy, modern revolutionaries, or have you, that aren't being tapped into, that you would like to see more artists sort of take up?
Well, for a movement as, you know, locally at least, for a movement as big as it's been, I haven't seen a lot of art in spaces, visual art in spaces. I haven't seen a lot of that. And as a matter of fact, one of my biggest criticisms of folks that were like tagging up downtown in Oakland is that it's ugly. Like, if people were hitting up things that made it beautiful, there would be no, the media wouldn't even talk about it because they wouldn't want people to like it, right? But some of the folks that are doing that have the idea that they want to make people not like it, and it's jarring. But I don't think that that's, you know, a good political tactic. I think that we need, you know, we need murals up talking about the campaigns that we're doing, that specifically give different ideas. We need people to take over billboards and make new things that have, and you know, we have enough people, we have enough artists. I guess what I was gonna say, that I've always known a lot of progressive artists with nothing to plug into, right? And so people kind of come up with different things to talk about, and it, you know, maybe like a historical mural or whatever. But now there's this movement with campaigns going on that people could be doing things about that happen right there. So I think that's one aspect, and I think that there could be some really creative video things, even if, whether they're public installations or just stuff on YouTube that people could trade that you know, was done by people whose passion it was to create video art. But yeah, I think we've been extremely lacking on visual art within this movement. So.
Can I share something? Coming up in the 70s, in the early days of hip-hop, one of the things that was interesting, wasn't called hip-hop, but it was called the jam. And really what this was, like art to me, and using that as an example, is when community starts to come together. You know, you're doing some sort of activity, these expressions, they draw people around this proverbial campfire, so to speak. When you start looking at the role that artists play in different communities, it's absolutely essential. It's not like, you know, we do these things and then we do art. It's like your expression is part of that everyday thing. You sing because your songs have real meaning. You know, it's not just something you do and then sell. You paint and you do these types of things that I think oftentimes we say, well, we'll just call it art when it has a much deeper connection. So I say all that to say that over the years, I've always looked and I saw that when we start to move in a direction where whatever it is we're doing, and if art is a main factor, or if it's just what we do as people, we start to gather large audiences, it becomes a threat. And you can expect a reaction to breaking up that sort of coming together. When I look at the Occupy movement, you know, at first I didn't get the tents until I realized, like, you know, this is becoming the new town square. You know, you wake up and go, I'm going to go down there and just hang out, you know, because I'm going to see Boots. I'm going to see these different people there. And when it wasn't there, you realize that, okay, yeah, there are other spaces. I might go to my church. I might go here. But those are silos. It wasn't bringing everybody to this one place. And when you start talking to people in different parts of the country, it's always the same. Yeah, we were starting to get big crowds and people were coming in and, you know, and I think this way and he thinks this way and we can have a conversation and all of a sudden we start to create. And so whenever this starts to happen, that becomes a problem. If you're an artist and you're doing your craft and all of a sudden people are showing up at the venues, you know, and they're looking, they're like, okay, can we make money off this? And they might, you know, try to figure out how they can do that. But when it becomes a thing like, wait a second, they're informing people and they're walking out, you know, they're coming in dumb and they're coming out with fists raised up and they want to get involved with something, that becomes a threat. So let's start to break this up. Or in this case, as you said, let's erase it, you know, from memory. So we don't even know the names of some of these people. You know, we don't know that some of these things that have the potential to draw folks or inform people, is disappearing. So I would say that these expressions that we call art, we need to look at them in a much deeper way to understand that they're a form of communication for many. They're a healing type of thing for many. You know, when you can see your story and you can hear your story in a bigger than life scenario, that means something. You know, it's not like I'm just hurt. It's like, I really feel this. You know, and when you start feeling it, and then you start to be moved to action, and then other people feel that, and next thing you know, we're all in another headspace that becomes very threatening to those who want to maintain a certain type of rigid control. And the way that they do that is to erase history, put people in boxes, categorize, you know, and dismiss and dismantle. And so that says to me that we need to push more art, you know, at every chance that we get. Play those songs, you know, get those murals, encourage people to express and celebrate that and see them as an essential part of life versus just an add-on, like we're going to do the movement and then we'll add the art. And no, it's got to be all the same because it's really coming from all of our spirit. And I think oftentimes we deny the power of our spirit, you know, where it's not that I hear you, but I feel you. There's a big difference. You see what I'm saying? And if we move into that direction, I think we're going to be for the good, and we should also watch when they move to try and shut down that spirit because they're afraid that, you know, once I'm spiritually awakened, ain't nothing, I'll die for my people. You know, I will die for you. I don't care. I will take a bullet because I really feel that sort of love for the community. That's what they don't want us to have. That's what's scary, and art helps facilitate us getting to that mindset and that spiritual place.
All right. Okay, so we have time for one more question. Zach in the back.
Oh, awesome.
You were the lucky person.
I wanted to follow up with the comrade on the green. I do think that there's a whole layer of people who got involved in the Occupy movement who have a politics of impatience and some sort of political elitism in which they think, well, if people aren't with it, that's their problem, and our job is to push our actions to the most militant or most radical direction possible as they perceive that. And I have to agree that that's a wide layer of people in the movement. It certainly wasn't the majority, I think, but I think it, combined with state repression, had a crippling impact on the ability of the movement to grow. And I think that's why it is important for political organizations to set out some kind of political leadership, to say, oh, actually, we want to build a broad movement. We want to orient to people who haven't realized that we need a revolution in order to get what we need in life. They're still reformists. That's okay. We want to orient to them. And we have to constantly fight within our organizing spaces for those kind of politics. So I just wanted to agree with you, and that's exactly what the ISO is about. I wanted to ask three quick questions. Who are your favorite female MCs? If you could weigh in a little bit on the debate between you and the Minister J.R. Valerie, Minister of Education. And also, when Nas said, I think it was 2007, that hip-hop is dead. What do you think he meant by that? And do you agree with him? What do you have to say about the role of hip-hop today?
Let's see. Jean Grey, Invincible, Lauryn Hill. Those would be my, off the top of my head, famous favorite MCs. It's the debate between JR and me. To paraphrase where what he was saying, he wrote an essay and I answered in the comments, and then we went back and forth a little. To paraphrase what he was saying was that there are a lot of white people downtown, and talking about while the occupation was there, and that there needed to be more black folks involved. I don't know if he said people of color, but the context was that. And so my answer to him was this, is that being involved in organizing and in at least one group that was specifically all people of color, all black folks actually, young comrades. And with working with other groups that have tried to organize in the Bay Area, at least, and I'm just speaking from experience, that nobody has been very successful at organizing a large movement of people of color in Oakland. And so it's up for debate with what works. However, I will say that, and what I said to him was that, and at the time this was true, that Occupy Oakland had way more black folks from the hood than any other organization I had ever been in. And the reason was because of the politic. It was talking about organizing around economic need. And many of the organizations that have been organizing in neighborhoods, be they in neighborhoods in Oakland, in neighborhoods that have people of color in it, have purposely stayed away from a class analysis. And in doing that, it's stopped them from being involved with things that have to do with organizing around wages. Soon as you start talking about organizing in a way that helps people to survive more, then you get people of color involved. And that's one of the reasons, you know, many organizations kind of come from a period in which they want to stay away from the ideas of talking about changing the system, so they may be revolutionary themselves, but they kind of couch their campaigns in things that are really vague and not to the point. And that's why they're, you know, usually unsuccessful. And this, obviously there are a few exceptions, but I'm talking about things from police brutality campaigns to housing campaigns that have happened through, and folks have been unsuccessful. And the reason that people were excited about Occupy Oakland is it talked about doing things through direct action that actually affected people's paycheck and pocketbook. And folks saw the possibility, especially with the general strike, of a tactic that comes out of having a class analysis that hadn't been presented to folks of my generation or younger, you know, in our lifetime. And so my point, you know, he had a valid point about the difference in the percentages of folks that were involved, as far as how many people of color versus how many white folks were involved. And that's true, and that's something that needs to be worked on. However, I would say that handling things in the way that we have been handling it in the Bay Area is not a successful strategy. A lot of my personal feeling is that there, a lot of the lingo that we use, the approaches that we use are very, in the Bay Area, have been guided by folks that are very steeped in academia and in a movement that came because of the absence of a militant mass movement. Folks, you know, operated in spaces that were the only spaces to operate in. And out came a language that kind of separated them from doing work around things that have a class analysis. So out of all of this work, you know, this is the first time like a fast food workers union has even been attempted in Oakland. That just doesn't make it, or any sort of union that's, as far as I know, would, you know, maybe I'm wrong about this, but you don't see that type of work being done by folks that consider themselves radical. And so that was the essence of that debate. Because his thesis was that because of this problem, you know, folks shouldn't be involved in Occupy Oakland. And so that was what that debate was about. I don't remember your last.
Hip hop? No, it's like hip hop is dead.
I mean, I think that everybody thinks that the best music came out when they were in high school. And so, you know, folks come out and the music has changed and they don't like it. You know, that's just all it is he doesn't like the new stuff that's coming out. And it's no different than, you know, late 80s, early 90s, people wanting it to sound like Grandmaster Flash and Furious Five.
But I have a different take. I have a different take on where Nas is coming from and what he actually said to a certain degree. Even though you might look at his work and say, well, there's a contradiction there, but I think it's still a valid point. When he's talking about hip-hop is dead, he's really talking about the corporatization of that music in a very deliberate and very strategic way. And this is something that I think we
where
have to...
Where does he say that?
Well, I mean, I'm using the word corporatization, but he's basically talking about, you know, big labels coming in, consolidating, taking over, and then dictating ultimately what's going to be presented to the masses. Now, keep in mind, he's operating from this sphere. You know, he's coming from a school where, once upon a time, you know, a lot of what he might consider good music would be on these mainstream stations. These underground stuff would be on a Hot 97. Underground stuff would be on a KMEL. The problem, and I think, you know, he doesn't say this, but I just analyze, is that many people like him did an institution build. So they took their fan base, they took their neighborhoods and said, go here and, you know, and watch that. And those institutions said, oh, okay, if all these people from these hoods are going to watch us, we're going to make this a habit. I remember my boss at KML said, make the station a habit that they can't kick. I remember Dick Parsons when he was running Time Warner saying, make this reinforce learned behavior, and we're going to tell you how to do this. And so basically, you know, make this a habit so even if you don't listen to the station, you know the logo. Even if you don't watch, you know, even if you don't know who we are because you experience it directly, you still know what we're about. And you start to associate, in this case, hip-hop with these institutions. You associate hip-hop with KML, or Hot 97, or Power 106, or BET, and all that. And now those institutions are no longer in the business of saying, you know, let's give Nas a chance, and maybe we will play a coup, you know, Fat Cats, Bigger Fish, which is what we did. You know, now we're going to take their neighborhood and their audience, and we're going to make them obsolete in terms of their audience.
Well, that was already happening at the time. I mean, before he even came out.
Yeah, but...
So, I mean,
but,
like,
no,
to say
it was,
that was the better
94,
era
94, 94 was the key year that started to change in a very deliberate way. Because up to that point, you know, I'm just saying from working on the inside that we were allowed up until 94 to play whatever we wanted on those airwaves.
That's not true.
Yeah, I'm telling you, we could. At KML, we could. We could. I'm telling you that...
You had independent promoters.
I know that.
That dictated the
no,
the
they didn't.
Playlist.
I'm telling you the truth. As somebody that worked there, that on my show, on our show, when I was doing mornings, if we wanted to play a song, we could. Yes, there were independent promoters that came in and said, you know, these are the things that we wanted to do, but there was enough space for us to do what we're doing. Now, I'm not going to try and defend an institution that eventually moved into an arena where we went from being able to play what we wanted to somebody walking in once it became Clear Channel and saying, you're going to take these 3,000 songs out the room and you're going to replace them with 300. And then those 300 is going to be whittled down to literally about 100. And that's going to really be based upon, you know, money to the tune of 500,000, 300,000, whatever amount of money. We had a corporate dictate that we were going to follow. But just to answer where Nas is coming from, it's not just that. It becomes all the other touch points, magazines, videos, any place where that celebrity was going to be presented, concerts, all these types of things were going to be much more rigidly controlled than it was before. And he just was starting to feel it because he was one of those people that was starting to move out. But I only say all this to say that, I mean, we know this is happening, people in this room, but not everybody else who has become addicted to these things necessarily know. They have a feeling that there's a dissatisfaction. I don't want to see the same 10 records. I don't want to see the same old videos over and over again. But they might not know that there was this type of programming going on very deliberately. And I think that's something that we need to take up the challenge and start redirecting and institution building in other arenas so that people can go, can be unhooked from that habit. I hope this is making sense of what I'm saying. But I think, you know, when I leave the Bay Area, where we have a lot of people who are politically active, I see a lot more dependency on these institutions than I would like to see. You know, when I start going, like I spend a lot of time in Texas, and even though they have an independent scene, there's also a lot of folks that's like, if it ain't on the radio, if BET didn't say it, it don't exist. If Steve Harvey ain't talking about it, it doesn't go on. Because those corporations now have gotten folks of color, black folks, this goes back to your class analysis, that look like us and may sound like us and may use the same words, but they're very much in the pocket of those corporate institutions. And so they will have entire masses moving in a particular direction. And it becomes hard because you're like, well, he kind of sounds like, he says he's from the hood, he's using certain type of language, but his politics at the end of the day is definitely aligned with, you know, Wall Street interest, and that's something that people don't always peep immediately. And so you may have somebody like that come along and say a lot of things but never come up and talk about, you know, helping poor people. Barack Obama is a perfect example. He has the swag, he has the look, he's from the South Side, but he'll never say poor people. And his actions will say that he won't move in that direction as well, but everybody will get behind him 100%. And that's a hard thing to crack for a lot of people, especially when they're looking around and saying, this is the only hero that I'm seeing coming to me in mass media that I'm now addicted to.
Point of information, those debates between Boots and JR can be found at the SF Bayview, sfbayview.com. You just Google their names along with Occupy. I also throw down there Joseph Anderson, Berkeley. Get a lot of articles that I've written at davidd.com and the Bayview.
Okay. So it's getting really hot in here. So we're going to close it up. So. Before you move, we've got three quick announcements, and then come join us upstairs for the reception. So three quick announcements. Jeremy?
Okay, real quick, there's a flyer on your chair for a study group in the new Jim Crow. Boots talked earlier about, like, Bailey fighting against racism. Well, Michelle Alexander has done us a really huge service in identifying sort of, like, mass incarceration as a system, as the new Jim Crow that has replaced the old methods of social control after the civil rights and black power movement of the 60s and 70s. We're going to be discussing it at Frisco Fried in the Bayview 1 week from today, so I just want to encourage people to come. Come with us, have a good discussion, and have some good food.
Jesse?
So Lakeview Elementary has been mentioned a couple times. It's one of five Oakland public schools that's being shut down, displacing over 1,000 grade school children. All the schools being shut down are K-5s. And it's sort of become the flagship. It's directly across the street from the Grand Lake Theater, and there's a sit-in happening there now. It's been going on for years. Our union, the OEA, is involved, and what we really want are people to come out and support the sit-in. There is a rally, a press conference, but we want to mobilize for on Monday at 11 a.m. If people can come out anytime, but Monday at 11 a.m. there will be a press conference. There's also, as of Monday, there's going to be a public free school for social justice for kids, for a summer camp, basically, for kids from 9 to 3 every day. If you're interested in that, I have the information. I have a lot of information about the schools, the school closures. I'll just pass them out here. The schools are being shut down to be leased to the Emeryville Unified School District, to be used as offices for the Oakland Unified School District, and they're converting to charters. That's what's happening. And the kids who are being displaced are being put into already full classrooms, classes, schools, and they're building portables on already shrinking recess and playground yards. So that's what's happening in Oakland. It's union busting. All those teachers are being relocated. All the students are being relocated. It's not just about Lakeview. It's about the five schools that are being closed, and it's about the district's ongoing plan to keep displacing kids and converting our public schools into charters. So please come out. I have a small number of these little signs, and there's a lot of information on those flyers going around.
Okay.
How many folks know about all the stuff that's going on in Chicago with all the killings that's taking place? You keep hearing that? Well, I mean, one of the things that you should know, kind of related to that, a lot of that has been mass displacement of people from one neighborhood to another. You know, we have Fred Hampton Jr., who's in town. We're going to probably do something with him to talk about that Monday. But that's something, if you talk to a lot of folks there, they talk about, you know, we're going to close this high school and send everybody to that high school, even though there's been these long type of rivalries and tensions. And, you know, that's Arne Duncan's plan. I think it's called Renaissance 2010 or what, something like that. But this whole thing is, you know, it's something to consider, because the potential for that to really blow up in Oakland is there when you start having that as well. People basically fighting over limited resources. And so that's something that I think we should all pay close attention.
Okay. Todd?
Just a brief announcement. The Haymarket book table is outside. You can pick up, you can get the brochure, which is announcing Boots' new book, out in August. There's also a big spread out there, including the Michelle Alexander book and Jim Crow. In addition to that, as people have talked about the conference so far, we have a raffle. So there's tickets out there you can get. We'll also bring those tickets upstairs. It's a great prize. It's a $200 gift certificate to your choice. So for $5, get a couple raffle tickets. Help us get some folks who need scholarship money to get to the Chicago conference. So either outside or upstairs.
Okay,
and please come and join us.
Yeah, and they lied. And there's one more quick announcement. Diana.
Sorry, I don't mean to. I'll be really quick. I just wanted to highlight that Archbishop is here, and we've been fighting for his home in Bayview for months now, and we have successfully postponed his auction. But it's just a postponement. So we'll keep everyone updated. Yeah. If you really want to get involved in the foreclosure, the work that we're doing, you can see me or Julian. And we definitely need as many people to like help not postpone his auction, but like literally his whole block in the Bayview. So we need as many folks as possible.
Okay. Thanks for coming out.
So, hey, so what are you talking about when they were making you all pay to get your stuff on?
Yeah, like, not just, like, it would be, like, the program director would be, like, you have to go through these.
You're talking about
Keith Nassar. That was also at Wild.
That was Michael Martin.
Yeah,
Michael Martin worked with the gay ministers. I'm talking about when we first came on, that cat didn't fish at all. The labor might have said they paid, as in charge you, but that came when we started playing at a club on the 6th. That was just
going. Oh, you're talking about a mixed show.
No, well, the mixed show then dictated what could you play, limited time and limitations. We had the management. Trace and Friends are more allowed to play. Without, you know, Keith didn't come to us and say, you can't do that. Now, Keith had a program. You know, there was stuff in order. But most of his money, if any, was coming from Tommy Matone and all those guys. So when they came and said, we want Mariah Carey, that's that money. Some shit like what you were doing, we was in the thing, you know,